This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Ela Kislansky.
And we're your hosts for Art Moves. Well, anyway, Eli, how you doing? You okay, Eli? You good? You good? You feeling it? You feeling the vibe? Well, I'm feeling the vibe because we have somebody in here that, you know, I am a huge fan of. Fan of hers artistically. I'm a huge fan of hers as a person because Lynn Nottage, she shows up. She shows up. You make us so proud, Lynn. I say that from the bottom of my heart. So we are delighted to have Lynn Nottage, playwright, here on Art Moves. So, Lynn, talk to us about what your favorite, what kind of art moves you?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. I'm really delighted. And what kind of art moves me? I think that I gravitate toward art that challenges me, art that inspires me, art that really forces me to see the world from another perspective, whether that be spoken word, whether it be visual arts, whether it be music. I think that what I'm looking for is something that really takes me outside of myself.
Wow, that's like outside the comfort zone. I love that, art that challenges me.
Yeah, and also it's a rarity too, because there's a lot of stuff out there that's, you know, well produced and clever, but it's like, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. You're the first woman to win 2 Pulitzer Prizes. Okay, the first. What does that feel like, and how did that change the trajectory of your career?
I think affirmation is always welcome. And it's always surprising, because when I sit down to write, I'm not necessarily writing because I'm hunting for awards or looking for that kind of validation. But also when you get 2 Pulitzer Prizes, it puts a little pressure on you. You know, I think about, well, what am I going to do next? How am I going to continue to invest in creating work that feels authentic and feels honest and that is pushing the envelope and taking me in new directions?
Is that scary?
It is scary.
Yeah, don't you think that's scary?
Well, you think about how many people out there, sort of like Orson Welles and people like that, you know, or, you know, a variety of people wrote, you know, after Citizen Kane, what did he do? Not that much after. So there could be an aspect of it that you get frozen from it.
I know. There's always that fear, yeah, that you won't find a new inspiration. There's always the fear that you won't be able to top the thing that you did last.
So that's normal, huh? Because I struggle with that too, even though I'm not at the level that you are. It's the idea of keeping yourself going, keeping it fresh. But then I think that there's a higher purpose in your work. Don't you think that helps drive it, the greater good that comes from it?
Well, thank you for saying that. I don't know whether there's a higher purpose, but certainly when I sit down to write, I write with intention. Mm-hmm. And I try to figure out how I can be in conversation with the culture and what's happening in the moment. And I think that that's in some respects what keeps the work relevant and what keeps the work in conversation with audiences. I think that if I wasn't in some ways trying to be in dialogue, that I would lose my way.
I love that conversation with the culture,
you know? Yeah, totally. Thinking about your process, because I saw a bunch of videos, and it was quite fascinating that you do an extensive amount of research, but in a lot of ways, you're also doing sort of this multimodal sensing thing, you know? And you mentioned something about a woman, the way she held the words in her mouth.
Sure, that was when I was doing research for a play called Ruined, which takes place in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it centers a brothel where women who've been fleeing the armed conflict find refuge. And I was really interested in how that armed conflict was impacting women who had been victims of gender-specific human rights abuses. And I discovered that I couldn't find a lot of information in the periodicals that were in the U.S. And so I discovered that I had to actually go to East Africa and interview women and hear their stories. And what I discovered is that very few people were invested in fully listening and amplifying what was happening to the women there.
You know, I went to see Ruin because I've seen so many of your plays. I've seen Ruin, Sweat, Intimate Apparel, the opera, as well as MJ, which we're going to talk about because that was incredible. But I walked away from Ruined just feeling bad, you know, because of the stories. But I was glad to be informed, but it was tough. How was it for you to be in that space with that particular play?
That's such a great question. Mm-hmm. And it was a tough play, but hopefully you left with a tiny bit of optimism.
But the subject matter.
The subject matter was hard. It was hard to interview the women. And I remember one of the very, very first women who I sat down with, and she said, you know, no one has listened to my story from beginning to end. And I was really clear when I was talking to her, and I conducted interviews with director Kate Worski and my husband, Tony Gerber. And we said to the women, it's like, we're not human rights workers. We're not doctors. We're not lawyers. We're not really in the position necessarily to change your circumstances. But what we can do is listen to your stories and perhaps in some way amplify them and let the world know what is happening to you. And this woman then proceeded to tell a story that was so gruesome and so difficult that I literally thought that my heart was going to jump out of my chest.
Yes,
and I thought, how am I going to be able to sit here and interview 15 more women? But I thought, this is the contract.
And
as a storyteller, sometimes we are charged with going to places that are difficult. You know, I teach. And one of the things that I tell my students is that as a writer or as an artist, our job is to go and stand at that edge of the cliff, even though that gust of wind is blowing and we may be blown over, and look down and observe what's below so that the people who stand back can say, what do you see? And so there is some danger embedded in being a storyteller, and there is some responsibility embedded in being a storyteller.
I love what you just said, especially about the contract, you know, because there's pieces of your work that almost made me think of you as a historian, you know, in the way that you were documenting a specific time. With Sweat, you had a similar process, did you not, where you did interviews with people? Could you talk to us about that?
Sure. I began interviewing people, I guess it was in 2011, around the time that Occupy Wall Street was happening. And we were really beginning to sort of shine a light on the disparity, economic disparity in this country. And I decided that I wanted to figure out the ways in which poverty and economic stagnation was shifting the American narrative. And like once again, like Ruined, I found that there wasn't enough information. And so I decided that I was going to travel to a town, Reading, Pennsylvania, which at the moment was the poorest city of its size in America, and try and interview as many people from top to bottom as I could. And around that same time, I had received a commission from Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which is a large theater in Ashland.
It's in the news right now.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it's very much in the news. In Ashland, Oregon, and they had this very bold initiative, which was to ask writers to write about American revolutions, but they also invited us to write plays that were big, because they said, because of economics, American plays are getting smaller at a time when we need plays to be big and tackling big subject matter. And one of the things that I decided after I got that commission and after going to Reading, Pennsylvania, that I wanted to look at the deindustrial revolution, because I felt like it was having as much impact as the industrial revolution had on our country, and yet we weren't talking about it.
The deindustrialization of the country.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm thinking about the body of your work that I've had the pleasure of seeing, you know, Sweat, Ruined, Intimate Apparel, the opera, and MJ. And I must say, when I saw MJ the musical, I'm saying this, it was the best experience I've ever had on Broadway.
Oh, thank you.
I went with my sisters and we all went out. We were just so high. And we talked about that play for a couple weeks after. You know, what was it like to have so many plays in production. You had Clyde's in production, you had Intimate Apparel, the opera, and then you also had Michael Jackson. How do you do that?
It was exhausting.
Yeah.
To begin with. It was challenging. But, you know, in some ways, and this is going to seem like a perhaps a strange response, but coincided because of the pandemic and COVID, because things were postponed. And then suddenly when we came out, everything was being produced all at the same moment. But during the pandemic, I really had time to ruminate and reflect and to rest. And I developed a meditation and mindfulness practice.
Oh, I did. So many of us did that during COVID. Yes.
I think I was able to carry that into the rehearsal process, so that when I was sitting in the rehearsals for Michael Jackson, I could be 100% present and there and not thinking about, oh, in an hour, I have to head, you know, a couple blocks uptown and go to Clyde's or go to Intimate Apparel. And I think that if I hadn't had that discipline and wasn't able to compartmentalize in a productive way, it would have been impossible. It was exhausting. There was a moment where I was working. We started rehearsal September 17th. I worked every single day from September 17th to February 1st without a break, every single day. And some of those days were 10 to 12.
You know, I found that meditation almost helped me to understand how to be a magnet, how to attract. So thank you for sharing that. You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And we're talking to Lynn Nottage. Thank you so much, Lynn. Let's get back to that mindfulness piece. You're saying that mindfulness really helped. Talk a little bit. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure. The pandemic was really difficult for all of us for a multitude of reasons, but theater was hit particularly hard. Our livelihood was cut off from us for over a year and a half. Nothing was happening on the stages. And so we had to figure out ways to pivot and ways to keep our spirits high. And one of the things that I turned to was meditation, is sort of focusing inward so that I could maintain my sanity and maintain my optimism and maintain reasons for continuing to write and be invested in my craft, knowing that there wasn't a space to ply my trade.
So I want to ask a little question about background. You know, we share a common one. We both grew up in Brooklyn. I was talking about, you know, I'm sure this happens to you. You find that you're taking your life circumstances that informs and sources your play. I'd be interesting to hear you talk about how that shows up. And
I'm sure. I mean, it's interesting because I tend to think that I don't write a lot of autobiographical work, you know, perhaps with the exception of Intimate Apparel, which is a play and now an opera that's near and dear to my heart, which really came out of me wanting to understand my great-grandmother and my grandmother who both lived in Brooklyn at the turn of the century, but for a multitude of reasons, I knew very little about them. And so in some ways, the play became my quest to understand who were these women, particularly my great-grandmother who came to New York at the turn of the century when she was 18 years old. She was one of eight, and I can imagine she probably had very little money, but somehow she managed not only to make a living, but to bring all of her other sisters here.
Where did she come from?
She came from Barbados, and she was a seamstress, and she corresponded with a man in Panama who came over, then they subsequently married. And that became the seed of the idea for Intimate Apparel.
That is so interesting because I felt that there was some of you in that. There was this dynamic, though, between, I guess that was your great-grandmother and the Jewish shopkeeper. Why was that story infused? Is that also autobiographical, or was that just something that you put in there? I wanted to understand that dynamic because he was like the one that was, you know, really seeing her, whereas her husband was kind of a little wavered.
The answer to the question is yes and no. Yes, you know, there are little strands of autobiographical DNA that are in there. It's my husband is descended from Romanian Jews and who were immigrants. And I was imagining if we lived back then, what would our relationship be like?
But you know what? I felt that, Len. I got that. Go ahead.
It was also, the play is about intimacy. And I thought, what if the most intimate relationship Esther, who's the central character has, is with someone she cannot touch? And so how do you express yourself emotionally and physically when there is this religious divide, when he, as an Orthodox Jewish man, loves her, but because of his religion, he's unable to express that physically? And so I was really interested in that dynamic, because so much of the play is about tactile engagement. It's touching fabrics and intimacy.
I have to tell you, that's how I read that. I thought the writing was beautiful. Why the opera?
The opera came about via Ricky Ian Gordon, who is the amazing composer. And I had seen an opera that he had composed and was a great admirer. And so when he reached out to me and said, would I be interested in writing an opera? I'm like, oh, of course. And so for 2 years, we actually read plays and we looked at movies and read books, trying to figure out what to adapt. And then one day he said to me, he's like, you know what I really want to adapt? It's Intimate Apparel. And I'm like, oh my God, that's what I really wanted to adapt. And it was funny that we spent these 2 years circling what both of us were drawn to, which is Intimate Apparel. And in some ways, its perfect form might be an opera.
So one of the things you like to write about in your plays and work is these morally ambiguous characters like Clyde. So what is it about that? Why do you like to, what attracts you to these kind of characters?
You know, the honest answer is I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. Other than I find them fascinating and challenging, you know, I'm interested in people. You know, you take Maminati, for instance, who is a woman who has to make compromise choices in order to survive. And I think that's also true of the character Vera Stark and perhaps to a lesser extent with Clyde, who is sort of more binary than the other characters. But I think I'm really interested in that gray area, that space that we occupy when we have to make difficult choices. And those choices may hurt the ones that we love, but they are the choices that we have to make in order to survive.
But it seems also a fascination with kind of gray areas, because it sounds like in the Intimate Apparel, you're almost like having a dialogue with the ghost of your great-grandmother, because she's not alive, she's not around.
Yeah, in some ways, I think the play was very much a dialogue. I wrote it soon after my mother died, and it was a play that I poured a great deal of emotion into because I wanted to feel close to her. And so I think that when I see the play, I feel my ancestors. Hmm. I feel all of those wonderful Black women who are the foundation of who I am.
So speaking about like the powerful Black women you life. One of them was your mother, Dr. Rube Nadic, and she was a beloved community leader. But I imagine in many ways she not just inspired you, but also supported you as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about my mother. I'm not sure why she's been visiting.
Do you hear
me,
though, or do you feel?
I just feel her.
I feel, right? Okay.
Yeah, I've been feeling her a lot recently. And in fact, today I was thinking about her, and I was thinking about her laughter, and I was thinking about how she was a community builder, and she was a nexus person, and that she was deeply invested in not just her family, but you know, the people who inhabited the spaces around her. And I was just missing her and missing that energy.
But you feel that energy, right? Meaning that's what happens with me in missing those that have passed on. I feel that I still have that relationship, that I'm still talking to them. But of course, we do want to see them in the physical.
We do want to see them. Also, my mother had this magnificent voice. Uh-huh. And one of the things that I really miss is her voice. And I was trying to remember it because, you know, I describe it as she had a voice in which you could always hear the smile.
Oh,
That's where you put it. Right?
That's beautiful.
And so, yeah. And to answer your question, I think that my mother and both my father were civil servants. I mean, my mother was a school teacher. My father was a social worker, and they weren't artists per se, but they brought me up in a house that was filled with art. They had many friends who were visual artists and musicians and theater artists, and they taught me that there was so much to learn beyond sort of the confines of the schoolhouse, that our education happened in theaters and in museums and around the dinner table in which lively conversations were being had.
That's amazing.
You know, it came to mind when she said that.
What? What came?
Like in my household, you know, I know what they say, they appreciated art. Art was like first thing from the mind, but they did have an appreciation. My mother and father had an appreciation for opera. But the funny part is, unlike your mother, my father used to sing arias.
He was probably having a lot of fun with that, right? There was something else. Well, so much of your words are just captivating, and they have a power. And you talked about when you write characters, you want to replace judgment with curiosity. Can you speak about that? Because I think that's what we need today. We need to suspend judgment and be more curious about each other.
I think when I came across that phrase, for me, it really expanded the way in which I wanted to approach my practice, and not just approach my practice as an artist, but how I wanted to engage with people and with art in my life. And so one of the things that I do is, rather than immediately push away from things that challenge me, is I ask the question, why is this challenging me?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I sort of interrogate the work rather than running away from the work.
Hmm. That's courageous. You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
We're talking to the notable Lynn Nottage. So in listening to your conversation about how you're influenced by so many different things, of course, it almost seems that to a certain extent that there's almost like a guidance from ghost in a way. You know what I mean? Like, do you ever feel that sometimes that your hand is guided by the voice of your mother? Or
you know, I actually feel the opposite.
The opposite. Mm-hmm.
Strangely, I felt liberated as an artist when my mother passed away, because I felt like I no longer had to be in the shadow of her judgment. I no longer had felt like I had to fulfill whatever desires that she had for me, that I could be completely sort of unencumbered as an artist.
Right?
Yeah, I understand that as well.
Don't you think that sometimes when you lose somebody, you start to really get them?
Yes, it's true. I feel like today, and my mother's been dead for 25 years.
Oh, wow.
And I felt like I had a new relationship with her.
Yep, that's what's forged. Now, I'd like to sort of segue into the business, okay? The business of Broadway, so to speak. And this lady has been able to have many more, but successful Broadway productions. How does that happen? Because you must have some sort of a business mind. How do you make that happen for yourself?
I don't know that I have a business mind, but I certainly am tenacious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I feel I've been driven, and I'm also a workaholic.
Well, we can certainly talk about that public statement that was on Broadway that talked about diversity, equity, inclusion. I forgot the exact name of it, but it had to do with the Black theater.
Yeah, there were a number of organizations during the pandemic and after the cultural reckoning that really used the time to interrogate the practices, not just on Broadway, but off Broadway, and demand that the industry as a whole examine some of the practices that diminished, harmed, that made the people who were on stage and the people off stage feel unsafe. And those organizations were things like Black Theater United, and perhaps the one that most people know is We See You, White American Theater.
That's it. Yes.
Which was a letter that was written that many artists and arts workers signed on to, demanding that the mainstream white institutions interrogate their practices. In September 2022, we had an unprecedented number of plays that were written by Black writers. I think that the end count was 9 in that season. Right. And I do not think that that would have happened without the scrutiny, if there hadn't been a movement on the part of like Black Theater United and We See You White American Theater. I think that it was pressure. I think that it was people saying, you know, we're kind of tired of being excluded from these spaces. We're kind of tired of our stories being undervalued because we are deserving of occupying this space. And there are audiences that have a hunger to see our story centered.
So what playwrights have influenced your work? Or are there?
Of course. Okay. I mean, that's like, I'm going to put my feet up because there's so many playwrights that have influenced me. You know, going back to one of the first plays that I ever read, which was Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun. But that said, I was also greatly influenced by plays that I saw as a child at the Billie Holiday Theater and at the Negro Ensemble, you know, plays that were written by Charles Fuller. But I was also influenced by Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller and Adrian Kennedy and Peter Barnes and Paula Vogel.
Did you have a call on your life? Meaning, did you know early on that this was what you wanted to do?
I think that I've always been a storyteller, you know. As a child, I wrote plays for my family, and me and my brother performed them in our living room. But I don't think that I thought of playwriting as a livelihood until I was leaving college. You know, I didn't know that as a Black woman that there was going to be space for me, because certainly when I was growing up, I didn't see a lot of work by people who looked like me on the stage.
So what's the future, Lynn? Meaning, what else is it that you're cooking up for us? Because, again, I'm just a huge fan.
I have to add something to that. Okay. It's like, what's also sort of on the peripheral of the rough ideas that you're considering? Not even in the realm of work in progress, but just sitting on the edge there.
Sitting on the edge. You know, there are a lot of things that I'm thinking about. I'm currently in the process of developing two new operas. One is for Opera St. Louis, which is a collaboration between myself and my daughter, Ruby Aya Gerber, who is a poet, yes. And it's inspired by a play that she wrote. And we're working again with Ricky and Gordon, who is the composer for Intimate Apparel. And then we also got a commission, Ruby and I, to write an opera for the Met Lincoln Center with a really super talented young Black composer named Carlos Simon. It's an Afrofuturist play, opera, I mean, which is super exciting. And involves really sort of incredible music, but also magic. And then, you know, to answer your question, I'm really, really interested in figuring out how to create a big piece of art in the public realm, you know.
Physical art or?
Well, just something. Something that is accessible and free, but also spectacular. So I'm not talking about community theater, but something that isn't in a traditional proscenium. But people come and they have a wonderful, full experience. And so
public outside. I
mean, yeah, public.
Yeah, interesting.
And it doesn't mean that it's, you know, it's in broad daylight, because it may be under a big tent, but it's a space where people don't have to necessarily pay $150 to see it, where they could be walking by and hear some noise and think, I'm going to stop and go and see what's happening in that big tent and sit down and leave having been sort of transformed in some way.
Well, Lynn, it has just been such a pleasure speaking with you, and we hope to have you again, because we didn't finish many of our questions. This is unfinished, but thank you so much.
Yeah, I have 40 more of them.
Well, thank you. This has really been a delight.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kozlansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.